You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up after 7, join NPR for continuing coverage of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia with analysis and live broadcast of the big speeches. That's coming up tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, podcasts and documentaries in the last few years have highlighted the lives of people who were convicted of crimes on allegedly shaky evidence. But if those people are granted hearings or retrials and eventually exonerated, what happens next?
In a new book called Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity, investigative journalist and author Allison Flowers looks at the lives of people who were exonerated after being wrongfully convicted of crimes. She follows the stories of people who had been exonerated after being convicted and shows the struggles of life after prison.
Here in Wisconsin, Jarrett Adams was exonerated in 2007 after a panel of judges declared him wrongfully convicted of sexual assault in Wisconsin when he was 17. He'd served almost a decade in prison before being exonerated, and he's now an attorney with the Innocence Project.
Allison Flowers and Jarrett Adams join us now. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Jarrett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me as well.
Allison, I want to start with the thing you start your book with. You talk about how there's not even an entry in the dictionary for the word exoneree, other iterations of that word, but not for the person themselves. What does that say to you?
Well, that's right. As I started working on this project and interviewing real-life exonerees, I discovered that as I typed the word exoneree into my computer, it was coming up on spell check and emails and Microsoft Word, you name it. And we don't have a word for the person. There's no word for this growing community of people leaving prison innocent of the crimes that sent them there, even though right now, on average, we have an exoneration every 3 days in this country. And I think it really speaks to how forgotten and how invisible these people are and the lack of resources for them.
I want to get a sense of the scope of what we're talking about here. Do we know how many people are exonerated after being convicted today?
Somewhat. There is a tracker called the National Registry of Exonerations out of the University of Michigan. They've been looking at this for a couple of years, and they basically aggregate and gather as much information they can about exonerations as they happen. I think right now we're at about, we're getting close to 1,900 exonerations since 1989. But I believe, and I think they would say this too, that it's in no way comprehensive. It's not like when a case is overturned or a vacation is vacated that, you know, a court or a judge or a lawyer or anybody sends out a press release, you know, or put some sort of notification out there that this has happened. So I think there are a lot of cases being overturned where the person is actually innocent, and we're not capturing those. So 1,900, there's about one every 3 days, but at the same time, there are a lot that we miss.
Jarrett, a lot of people saying, as Allison was getting at there, that they believe this number to be much higher than it actually is. Based on your story and what you've seen, do you agree with that projection?
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with that because, I mean, if you just think about it, that the technology hasn't really caught up with all of the cases yet, and it's just now getting there with DNA testing and, you know, just the court acknowledging that sometimes, you know, there is, you know, fault of the criminal justice system, you know, whether it be, you know, prosecutors making a mistake or missing this or missing that. And so it's anything man-made is bound to make a human error. So that's not the biggest issue. The issue is, okay, what do we do to correct it now? You know, how do we go back and how do we make sure that justice was ensured?
And Jarrett, you're an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York now, but this is also a story that you've lived. You've been through this. Can you tell us some of that journey from prison inmate to exoneree to lawyer? What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I spent almost 10 years of my life in prison, so I was a very young man, you know, wrongfully convicted. You know, family didn't have resources like a lot of the cases where you don't have the resources to buy an attorney. You get a public defender. This isn't a knock on all public defenders because public defenders are overworked and underpaid. And so, again, the system is fallible and sometimes things happen. You know, it took me to get the help of the Wisconsin Innocence Project and Keith Finley to advocate on my behalf and get my conviction overturned. And, you know, my record was dismissed. And, you know, I don't have a record, but I come home a 26-turning-27-year-old man with a 10-year gap in my resume, no credit history, no job skills. And so it was a very, very long road to go from someone who was, you know, wrongfully convicted, released, and then, you know, get off of my mother's couch one day and walk to school, enroll, and look, 9 years later, I'm graduating law school, taking a New York bar, and now I'm an attorney in New York. I may have made it look somewhat easy. However, it wasn't, and it took a lot of help. And it took a lot of things that I just wasn't afforded when I came home. And one of those things was just having a therapy, you know. You know, it's like it's a traumatic experience to go through something like that. And you come home and you've lost so much time. And, you know, one of the best things that happened to me was being able to get on the couch of someone and speak to them and let it all out.
Are there structures in place, Allison, for people like Jarrett, who might be exonerated, but there's a time lapse there. They get out, and it's not the same world as when they were convicted. What resources are there for these people?
Well, I think as Jarrett alluded, you know, there really are no resources. There's no aftercare for exonerees. There's nothing immediate for them. It's really a media myth that release from prison is this happy Hollywood ending. It's really not an ending. It's the beginning of another set of struggles. So when you leave prison as an exoneree, no matter where you are, you don't receive immediate compensation, not a dime. You don't even get a bus pass, which, you know, as many parolees will at least get that. There aren't any social services, no counseling, no medical, and your record is not automatically expunged. So you can't find work very easily at all. That's not to mention, you know, family members that may have died or moved on in your absence. And, you know, depending on where you were convicted, the state may or may not ever compensate you or compensate you very well. So there's still 20 states that do not offer any compensation. And many of the states that do compensate don't provide very much, Wisconsin being one of them. It's capped right now at $25,000 a year for $5,000 per year. And, you know, there was a bipartisan bill that was shut down this last legislative session. That was trying to raise it to $50,000 a year for every year you were incarcerated and capping it at $1 million. And that, you know, that was not able to move forward. And so, you know, especially exonerees in Wisconsin and exonerees in those 20 states that don't have anything at all, you know, there are no immediate resources. You basically have to hope for something like a civil lawsuit, which, you know, few cases are poised to handle civil litigation. You have to have some unique circumstances in order to sue the state for millions of dollars. So those cases are just very rare, and most exonerees are left without any resources or very few resources.
We're talking with investigative journalist Allison Flowers right now and attorney Jarrett Adams, who was wrongfully convicted of a crime as a teen. He was exonerated in 2007. And I wonder about the effect of pop culture on exonerations and innocence projects. I'm thinking of Serial and Making a Murderer, taking an interest in people convicted of crimes who might have far fewer resources than people with more privilege. Jarrett, do you think that these cases are having an effect, are changing the legal system?
I mean, I do, and that's one of the reasons why I respect the work that Allison does and the book that she made, because it's one of these things where the more people who hear about this and who hear about this being very real, the more people who will be receptive to it and also who will be open-minded enough to say, you know what, push this legislation through. Because this isn't so much a thing now that we know that the courts are acknowledging it and you're seeing different coverages on it happening more and more. This isn't a thing that is you know, should be missed and it made about nothing but financial compensation. There's compensation that finances can never make up for. And I'll give you a perfect example. You know, me coming home, it was very awkward to meet my niece and nephew at 9 and 7 years old. And, you know, we didn't know whether to hug or to shake hands because we never knew each other. And you can't make up for time like that. And I think that, you know, books like Allison's and these different series are bringing it to the living rooms of people who have never experienced this, may never experience it, and, you know, don't know anything about it. And so I think this is a very great topic to discuss. It's a real topic, and I think that we shouldn't shy away from difficult conversations in America. What makes us great is to take on these responsibilities to fix them and not point blame.
And, Jerry, you said therapy helped you when you were exonerated. That was one the elements that helped you make this transition. Now you're an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York, but I'm curious about what else you'd like to see to support people who go through this. It sounds as though there is no real compensation, but maybe there's more. Maybe you'd like to see something even more systemic before we get to that point. What are you looking for?
Well, if I had the magic wand, I would like to prevent these things from ever happening. However, I'm realistic, and I know that mistakes do happen. But like I said before, I would like to see the immediate reaction of, these picking up the pieces of people's lives that are ruined because of this. So I don't want to see you coming home and you got to litigate as to why, you should be compensated or given therapy or given health care. There are exonerees in Wisconsin, specifically Joe Fry, who came home and, he's at the age of retirement right now, but there's nothing for him to retire on. And that's just completely unfair, because what we're doing on the one hand in society is saying, we're not going to compensate you or help you, and we're going to dump you back onto society. And if you don't have a job, if you're not able to provide for yourself, then you become the responsibility of the taxpayers again. And I think it's totally unfair, and we should do something collectively about it.
We're talking with investigative journalist Allison Flowers, and attorney Jared Adams is with us. He was wrongfully convicted of a crime as a teenager and was exonerated in 2007. He's an attorney in New York currently.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guests? Do you think the criminal justice system fairly compensates people who have been wrongfully convicted? What do you think should happen when somebody's in that situation? They're exonerated, released from prison. What should they get? What should happen? And do you work in the criminal justice system? Tell us what you think about the way exonerations and convictions are being handled. Call in at 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our conversation with Allison Flower. She's a journalist, author of the book Exonerate Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. Jared Adams is with us also. He's an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York and was exonerated after serving about 9 years in prison.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the criminal justice system, that state government, should do for people who are released, who are exonerated, who judges rule were wrongfully convicted for a crime and then spent years, maybe many years, in prison? Call in at 800-642-1234. Or have you had an experience or someone in your family with this side of the criminal justice system? The number again, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Allison, we just heard Jarrett saying that ideally these convictions, these wrongful convictions, wouldn't happen in the first place. And I assume that's part of the goal here. What needs to happen to stop them before they happen?
Well, I think really two things need to be seriously looked at. One is police misconduct. I do think that there is a strong connection between official misconduct that you see among police and prosecutors and the number of people that are being wrongly convicted. I mentioned the National Registry of Exonerations, which tracks these wrongful convictions and exonerations. And because of the known cases, about 1,900 that are out there since 1989, we're able to examine the contributing factors to how those people were wrongly convicted. And one of the leading causes is official misconduct. So that could be, police having tunnel vision investigations, prosecutors hiding evidence or not disclosing evidence that is favorable to the defense, those sorts of things. Also, maybe incentivizing someone to testify against someone else in court. So the number one cause contributing factor to wrongful convictions would be perjury or false accusations. And that's basically as simple as someone lying about you in court. And so if we actually look at the gamesmanship that goes on in the courtroom, if prosecutors are more concerned about getting it right rather than making a deal with someone to testify against the person they really want to get and who, is later as a consequence of that wrongly convicted, I think that would go a long way in preventing wrongful convictions.
Let's take a caller now. We have Natalie with us from North Prairie. Natalie, hi.
Hi. I had a quick question. I don't think it's been talked about yet, but when you think about the ramifications of these decisions on people's lives when they're in prison for such a long time wrongfully, and I think it is evident there's no amount of money to make things right, are there professional ramifications for the people, whatever role they played in putting someone in prison wrongly, judges, police, lawyers, are they losing their jobs? Are they being disbarred? Because if it was me, that would bring me a little bit of a feeling of justice. And I can take my answer off air.
Natalie, thanks for that question. And what about that, Jared? Are there professional consequences for prosecutors, judges?
Well, I'll be completely... Well, thank you for the call, Natalie. Very rare. It's very rare. And it's a complicated situation, and it may be so complicated to explain, so I'll sum it up and say that it has to be something that is completely egregious for a prosecutor or an official to be held liable in their capacity. There are certain things that you can do as in your role as a prosecutor or as a police officer where you're protected by that role you did it in. You know, maybe you're investigating and maybe you do have tunnel vision. You know, maybe you really did believe a person was guilty, but evidence later proved that they weren't. That doesn't necessarily mean that you maliciously did something wrong. And it's kind of a loophole that needs to be fixed. And one of the things that I've been clamoring for the longest is I believe that there needs to be a separation between the police and the prosecutors. I don't think it's fair that they are able to have a relationship to where it's a working relationship and where the roles almost become the same. A prosecutor is able to participate in the investigation portion of questioning a person. And we've seen a whole lot of things in these cases that I don't think is fair. And I think that if you have a separate entity that is reviewing the evidence before it gets to the prosecution, and then allowing the prosecution to prosecute solely on the evidence that has been presented in front of them, I think that you'll have a lot less tunnel vision. I think that you'll have a lot less turning the blind eye to misconduct by police. And I think that you'll have a better result in the system. And to also follow up on the point that I think Natalie made is, it's not just the person who's convicted and who goes through the wrongful conviction that is suffering because of this. You're talking about family members. You're talking about coming home and you don't have a home. So you're asking your family to allow you into their home. And when you do that, you know, everything goes up, all the way from the light bill to the food bills to everything. And you're a grown man in many cases staying at your family's house with no insurance or nothing to contribute to the household.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Natalie. And let's take another call now. Christy is with us next in Madison. Hi, Christy.
Hi. What was striking me as listening to all of this is just Jared, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Jared.
That you were wrongfully convicted when you were so young. And it's incredible that you had the fight in you still when you got out. And you went and you got your college education, but it just struck me that, you know, that there's potentially other people who are in that same situation, and they basically got that early years to get their college education taken away from them, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and you went back and got your college education, and that's amazing, but you also had to do it later than other people.
Christy, thank you so much for that comment. And Jared and Allison, I'm going to ask you both to chime in on that briefly. Does some sort of compensation or fund need to be set up to allow for someone's education, especially if they're a non-traditional student, maybe they're starting later? Allison, we'll start with you.
Yeah. Well, there's one exoneree in my book named James Kleppelberg, and he was actually serving 6 life sentences for murder when he was exonerated. So he was accused of setting fire to a home that killed a family of 6. And, you know, in his situation, he was in a position where the Department of Corrections never viewed him as ever getting out. So why would they educate him, right? So, you know, he came out at retirement age as well. And, you know, he likes to say that when he went in, there were floppy disks, and he comes out, and suddenly people are getting emails on their phone. I think in terms of compensation, you know, there are some states that baked into their policies
around exoneree compensation do provide for some measure of education. I think that would be a wonderful thing to include. But, you know, right now there's just the state-to-state compensation laws are not uniform. And I think advocates who are seriously looking at this problem are suggesting something similar to the Texas model, which Texas actually has one of the best compensation statutes in the country. They offer $80,000 a year for every year that you were wrongly convicted or every year that you were incarcerated, and they offer that moving forward. So it's not just trying to compensate you for the time that you lost, but acknowledging that you have the rest of your life to live as well. And, of course, you know, a lot of people come clamoring to you, whether you're an exoneree who's been compensated or not. Again, most are not. But a lot of people come clamoring to you for access to that money. So getting a huge lump sum, while, of course, it's better than having nothing, can also bring its own complications. So ensuring that you have resources moving forward, you know, for education or just for living your life, retirement, and so on, is very important.
And we're out of time. Thank you both so much for joining us. Jared, I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Allison, thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much.
That was Jared Adams. He is a lawyer in New York currently and was convicted of sexual assault in Wisconsin when he was 17, then exonerated. He's now with the Innocence Project in New York. Also, Allison Flowers joining us, investigative journalist and author of The Exoneree Diaries. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.